Today, Nathan Law, the Hong Kong activist forced into exile in London. Nathan, can you tell me about your childhood? What are your early memories of growing up in Hong Kong?
Yeah, I was born in mainland China in 1993, and I came to Hong Kong with my mother in 1999. My parents are both blue-collar workers. My father was a construction worker, and my mother was a street cleaner. We're living in public estates, government-subsidized housing, and sometimes my family was relying on government subsidies. So I remember when I was young, I didn't have the luxury to enjoy much the things that make you cheerful. So I guess that's my humble background.
This is Nathan Law, one of Hong Kong's most prominent democracy activists. This month, he's been named one of Time magazine's most influential people of 2020. He's just 27. His years of campaigning have made him a target for the Chinese government. In the summer, he left Hong Kong when Beijing imposed a controversial national security law. He's now in London, having left behind friends, family, and fellow activists who have made the decision to stay. But Nathan's fight for democracy in Hong Kong continues.
Being a very high-profile overseas dissident, trying my very best to arouse the attention of the global community to be strong to China, I am worrying about my safety on a regular basis.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, why activist Nathan Law has been forced to flee Hong Kong. Emma Graham Harrison, you're the senior international affairs correspondent for The Guardian and Observer, and you've met Nathan Law. Who is he and what's he like as a person?
So Nathan Law is probably one of the most prominent pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong. In his spare time, he volunteers at rescue centres, or he did in Hong Kong, for abandoned animals. So he's this very kind of charming, charismatic guy, not just sort of in his politics, you could say, but sort of just in his life and his personality as well. He's incredibly young and has had this quite extraordinary life in a way. He began his political career really as a student leader during the Umbrella Movement, which was a sort of pro-democracy, largely student-led movement. The reason it was called the Umbrella Movement is that they became a symbol because the protesters were using them to protect themselves from the police use of crowd dispersals, tear gas and pepper spray.
People started to propose an idea of civil disobedience, which was also widely adopted when Dr. Martin Luther King had the civil rights protest in the 60s in the US. We occupied the major runways of Hong Kong for 79 days, but eventually the government refused to listen to us, and the government ended without making a concrete effort on having a democracy.
I mean, as you say, the protest didn't achieve its aims, but it must have been an incredibly exciting thing to play a part in.
Yes, of course. That was, I think, the first civil disobedience actions, massive civil disobedience actions in Hong Kong's history. When you are in the occupation site, there is a podium, is a few inches above the ground, and when you climb up the ladder, and you stand on the platform and you knock down. When it was at night, people were there, sea of people, and they were holding up their phone and turning on the flashlight, and you could see a sea of stars. And people were chanting slogans like "Democracy Now" really passionately. And in that kind of moment, you really feel the power of people. And it kind of made a strong impression in my mind. It's like faith imprinted in my head. I have that momentum and I have that drive to continue to fight for the democracy of the city, even though the path has been very turbulent.
Did you feel optimistic at that point in that fight? Did you feel positive that you would be able to achieve those democratic aims in Hong Kong?
Well, I think undoubtedly when you saw so many people coming out for the same cause and very determined, there was definitely a moment that you thought, oh, we are going to make history, we're going to make a change. But reality hits you back quite rapidly, and after an emotional flush, you realize that your opponent is so strong. We were talking about the largest authoritarian country in the world now. You soon realized every change is difficult. But by the time you have two choices, you can be pessimistic and give up, or you can be tenacious and continue. So I think most of Hong Kong people have chosen the second one.
In many ways, those protests were seen as sort of unsuccessful. They were broken up by the government after sort of just over 2 months. But if you speak to anyone from Law to Joshua Wong to any of the other kind of prominent figures who took part in those movements, they were a really important kind of forming ground in terms of tactics and techniques.
What role then did Nathan take on after the umbrella protests ended?
Nathan Law became a founding member of a political party and was elected to Hong Kong's legislature, but he didn't actually get to serve very long because of a controversy surrounding the oath that he took when he was swearing in. It wasn't just him, there were several pro-democracy lawmakers who were all ended up being disqualified. In his case, before he was sworn in, he gave a speech essentially attacking the government and quoting Mahatma Gandhi.
You can chain me. You can torture me. You can even destroy this body. But you will never imprison my mind.
As a result of all this, he was, along with these other lawmakers, was disqualified from Parliament and his seat was taken from him.
Nathan, becoming elected to the legislature and then being forced out was a big moment. And it cemented you as a political figure in Hong Kong. And it also meant there was a huge amount of attention focused on you. How did your family feel about that?
My family has not been politically active. They have been entangled with daily works that garner them bread and butter. So at first, they worry about me and oppose me from participating in politics, even though they are not like pro-Beijing people. They just want stability. And that's, like, to be honest, like, that's something I have never been able to offer them since I was involved in 2014. And I completely understand it. They fled also from mainland China. It was, well, economically, it was extremely unstable during their childhood growing up. And I understand that kind of pursuit when they successfully moved to Hong Kong and tried to stabilize their life. So at the very beginning, they were very doubtful and trying to persuade me not to get involved deeper and deeper. But at the end of the day, they understand that they're not going to change me.
Yeah, I know they're not going to change you. The frustration of a lot of parents, I think. Not long after that, along with your friends and fellow protesters, Joshua Wong and Alex Chow, you were sentenced to prison for your involvement in the umbrella movement. What was that like?
Well, I think that was I felt really, really bad during that period of time. In July 2017, a day after my 24th birthday, I was unseated under the court ruling, and in a month's time, in August, I was sentenced to 8 months of imprisonment. 1 month before my jail time, I was visiting the prison as a legislator, talking to all the superior officers in the prison. But on the next day, I have to be there. So it was quite a turbulent journey for me. So it was tough, but I think for me, I was quite relieved after I really make my mind straight that, well, present time for an activist in Hong Kong is inevitable. The government manipulated the legal system, and the court is getting more and more aggressive towards protesters, and the government prosecute anyone that they like under the autocratic leadership. I managed to go through it really peacefully and calmly.
You served 2 months of an 8-month sentence. What kept you going through that time?
The love from the people and the support from them are actually my key driving force for me to move forward. And along the journey that you walk through in your political life, you have seen so many people suffering from a lot of injustice from the government and also political prosecution. And when you feel them, it translates into your responsibility and duty to move 1 mile more for them.
You've had to shoulder a lot of responsibility. Does that ever feel overwhelming?
Yeah, for an activist, it's always difficult to balance everything. For example, I mentioned about the expectation of my families, and it's devastating for me to always disappoint them when they feel like you're not really having a stable life and putting them in a very worrying position on a constant basis. And as an activist, you have a lot of things that personally cannot achieve or attain. Your relationship goal, your life goal other than politics, it all screw up by your political participation. And also people pay expectation to you, and you will demand yourself harder and harder. And sometimes it will burn you out. It's not an easy task for me to admit that it's okay for me to feel a bit tired and to try to have a rest and continue. Well, there have been a period of time I demand myself so much that I was suffering emotionally. But it's a life lesson. You keep learning and you keep advancing.
Emma, the next chapter in Nathan's story and the story of Hong Kong feels like last year when millions took to the streets in protest. Can you remind us how those demonstrations began?
They began as a very specific protest movement against an extradition law. The government wanted to pass this law that would have made it possible for Hong Kong authorities to extradite suspects to mainland China for trial. And for a lot of people in Hong Kong, the idea of an extradition treaty with mainland China really struck at the heart of the city's identity. You saw these incredible peaceful protests, the largest one, 2 million people turned out. And in response, there were very brutal tactics from the Hong Kong police, very harsh response, a lot of use of tear gas, of force. And so then the protest became about police brutality as well. And then eventually the movement morphed, I would say, into a broader pro-democracy movement, with people sort of making broader demands for representative government, really, for democratic rights in Hong Kong.
You were covering these protests, Emma. What was that like for you as a reporter?
Particularly at the beginning of the protest movement, it was really extraordinary and inspiring, really, to be out on the streets. Although Hong Kong is part of Greater China, where obviously there is no right to protest. So being in Hong Kong and seeing people turning out literally in their millions, it was really a very kind of inspiring demonstration of sort of the best of sort of democratic ideals, the idea that people have power to change things peacefully if they show up, if they care enough. But then, obviously, over the months, the mood in the city, the situation in the city changed dramatically.
We're in the Admiralty area. We understand there are a number of demonstrations around the city. You can see they're firing tear gas now, and they brought out the water cannons, so people are panicking a little bit. We understand there are unconfirmed reports. Three live rounds have been fired. It has been absolute mayhem here for the last few hours. A number of fires in a number of different areas of Hong Kong. We've seen water cannon being fired.
Violence escalated. You know, protesters became much more violent. The police brutality also escalated. If you spoke to a lot of the protesters, they would often say to you that they didn't necessarily think that they were going to achieve what they wanted. But I heard from many protesters, we have to come out anyway. We're not coming out because we have hope. We're coming out because in the future that might not be possible. And in fact, that proved to be very prescient, because the national security law, which China brought in literally overnight at the end of June, no one in Hong Kong was allowed to see the law. The first time anyone could read it was when it came into force, has essentially criminalised most of the protest movement.
How does the new national security law limit protest? And is this why it's been so controversial?
It was controversial for several reasons. The first was that it was passed in Beijing, not in Hong Kong. The law allows, for instance, Chinese security agencies to set up offices in Hong Kong. And it also criminalises a lot of activities that before were protected as part of Hong Kong's protection of civil rights. It also has this other clause, which has caused a lot of consternation, which is that it essentially gives China jurisdiction around the world. So anyone who makes any comment that is considered in violation of this law anywhere in the world could potentially be pursued for that if they landed in Hong Kong.
That's very draconian. You know, for ordinary people living in Hong Kong, does that impact them on them now?
So obviously what the Chinese government would say is that, you know, as long as you're law abiding, you have nothing to fear. But the reality is that it has dramatically changed Hong Kong. It's been used to undermine academic freedoms. Political groups have had to disband. So Nathan Law's, the political party that he was part of, and several other political parties had to disband themselves. It appears to have been applied retroactively, which is very alarming. So people have been arrested for doing things before the law came into force.
Nathan, do you remember the moment when you first heard about the national security law?
Yeah, I remember that we all saw the news of the law coming, of course, in the news outlets.
So happening in just the past few minutes, China's national parliament has approved a controversial national security law for Hong Kong, which criminalizes acts of sedition and terrorism.
Now, and we were like, unbelievable, like it was so draconian. So at the beginning, we didn't believe that Beijing would do such a bold move, actually, because it will intrigue international repercussion and it'll be a huge scandal for the Communist Party. But eventually they did it. And I think that was the time that we, or at least me for myself, I really had to think of whether I should stay in Hong Kong, not only for my personal safety, which is of course in grave danger, but also for the continuity of our international advocacy work. Because one of the fronts that the national security law wanted to target is the international advocacy work.
So you decided to leave. What was it like stepping onto that plane and knowing that you might not come back to Hong Kong again?
I only have my backpack and my hand-carry suitcase with me. And when I stepped into the airport, I was afraid that I would be stopped because this is what authoritarian regime treats its dissidents. Sometimes they let you go, sometimes they don't. So I was afraid that I couldn't go past through the gates, and luckily I could. And when I really boarded the plane, that kind of anxiety relaxed. And what substituted was a true feeling that I'm really leaving the city behind me, possibly for decades. And when the plane took off, I looked down to the skyline, to the light view of Hong Kong, which was so vibrant and so impressive. I was thinking that that was probably the very last time I was going to see it in a very long period of time. And it was tough. But I carried a mission and a responsibility with me. And I understand that no matter how difficult emotionally that was, my decision is more than myself.
Coming up, Nathan arrives in London to an uncertain future. Emma, why of all the places in the world did Nathan Law decide to come to London?
So I think it's really interesting. I mean, part of that, you could say, is the UK's cultural ties with Hong Kong. There's a lot of Hong Kongers who've lived or studied or worked at some point in the UK. The UK is also going to be potentially a very attractive place because the British government has made a offer of a path to citizenship, which actually covers millions of Hong Kong residents. And the government's own figures estimate that in the next 5 years, up to 200,000 people might take them up on that offer. So I don't think this would be a factor for Nathan Law, because he's such a prominent figure, he would probably get asylum anywhere he wanted it. But I think for a lot of other protesters, people who aren't as well known as him, Britain has offered a path to citizenship for all holders of British national overseas passports, which were these slightly strange colonial era documents that gave people a right to British consular protection when they were travelling, but not the right to live in the or work in the UK. And essentially, Boris Johnson has kind of upgraded those passports so that they now, it's not a full right, you can't just fly into the UK and settle here, but they give you a path through which you can build a life in the UK and eventually become a full British citizen.
Why do you think the UK government is doing this? I mean, were you surprised when you first heard about it?
Yeah, I was very surprised. I mean, you know, this is a government that has sort of built a reputation for itself and you know, an electoral policy on a sort of what they would describe as a hard line on immigration. So to come up with this policy, you know, which is a generous and very positive response to the pressures that have been brought to bear on Hong Kong citizens with this new law, was very surprising, yeah.
Nathan, you've been in London for a few months now. Have you been able to have any contact with your friends and family since you got here?
I haven't been in touch with them since I left. And I announced in my public statement that I severed my ties with them. Because when we take reference from the implementation of the national security law in mainland China, it does not only target the person who they wanted to prosecute, it also threatens and harm their families. Some of the human rights lawyers' children and their families suffered from the harassment of the authority. Like, the children cannot go to school. Their whole families are being surveillanced and monitored. The wife cannot leave the country, etc. And for me, the only thing that I could do to protect them is to cut all my contacts with them.
Do you feel safer now you're in London?
Of course, comparing staying in Hong Kong on the Chinese Communist Party's soil is safer. But I mean, it's difficult to say that you're completely safe, as we all have been like seeing news about how authoritarian regimes poisoning dissidents around the world. And sometimes I wonder whether the next would be me, even though I don't really have any concrete evidence or warning signal that shows me I will suffer from that. But it's difficult to really not to think of it, because you understand how angry like Chinese Communist Party is when they read about you, when they use the whole propaganda machine to do smearing campaign on you. And well, to be honest, I'm walking to a path that not many Hong Kong people have walked.
We've just recently heard that Joshua Wong, you know, one of your friends, a co-leader of your movement, someone you've worked with for a very long time, has been arrested again. And in August, we saw the newspaper tycoon Jimmy Lai dragged out of his office and arrested. How does it feel not to be there at this time with all of this happening?
Well, of course, it's difficult. You always wanted to share that kind of pain and moments of disappointment with all your fellows. But I understand that I've been on the duty, which is to broadcast that truth and the demands of Hong Kong people from here. So I think even though I feel bad, but I'm doing something for our shared cause, and that is enough.
How do you see the protest movement in Hong Kong progressing now? I mean, speaking to you, listening to you, it feels very difficult to understand how the aims can be achieved with these new laws in place that are so wide-ranging and draconian.
Well, of course, in short-term future, we are all pessimistic, but I think when the global ties is changing, when China is being punished for its gross human rights violation, and when they realize that there must be changes in order to survive the change of Hong Kong, it's not going to single-handedly achieved by Hong Kong people. We also have to have a global tide and more democracies feeling that threat from China is real and trying to implement measures to hold them accountable. I think that is the light in the darkest time, and we should grasp it.
Essentially, the only tool that Hong Kong sort of pro-democracy campaigners and protesters have in their fight is international support. It's really hard to see China making any concessions at all, but, you know, perhaps, like you might say with the Tibetans and the Dalai Lama, the influence on Chinese policy in Tibet has perhaps been very low, but he has preserved the idea of Tibetan identity in exile. He has kept the issue of Tibet, given it very high visibility internationally. So, you know, I think an effective campaigns by Hong Kongers who are in exile will be very important to trying to keep their cause on the international agenda.
Emma, what is the future for Hong Kong, and what is China's ambition for the region?
Essentially, the national security law has brought an end, I would say, to Hong Kong's semi-autonomous status in real terms. And I think, you know, that authorities in both Beijing and Hong Kong want to use the law to essentially crush dissent in Hong Kong. They probably envision it in an ideal scenario being something like a Chinese Singapore, where there is not really much political plurality, but you have a very healthy business sector, I think, in their sort of, you know, their ideal outcome from this. You know, there's a lot of very brave people in Hong Kong who are very committed to continuing their struggle. But the space for that is definitely shrinking.
It must feel very strange not knowing whether you'll ever be able to return to Hong Kong. How do you see your future now, Nathan?
Well, I can't see my future. I'm a person without future. Just try to imagine when I was elected in 2016, I would have never imagined that 4 years after, in one term's time, I'm in London and cannot go back to Hong Kong. What I have is now, what I have is present. And I have to see it as a present for me in order to really do whatever I need to do and to explore the future step by step. And I would see the contribution to the movement as my priority.
Nathan, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you so much.
That was Nathan Law and Emma Graham Harrison. You can read Emma's reporting on Hong Kong at theguardian.com, where you can also find the excellent Fight for Hong Kong series, which this week is looking at the implications of the national security law, not just in Hong Kong, but all over the world. Thanks to Nathan and to Emma for speaking to me today. This episode was produced by Joshua Kelly and myself, and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.